Okay, welcome to another edition of Q's in a Pod. I'm surprised you're still listening. I don't think anyone does.
Well, I mean, you know, it doesn't matter. It's out there. It'll be listened to eventually.
Yeah.
Statistically speaking.
By historians.
Yes. Tonight, we have Daniel Evans, our secular occultist, Tom Quackbush, our fantasy author, and in the distance, doing homework, we have Amber Hawk.
Hello.
We're going to make sure she doesn't talk too much.
Yeah,
until she can actually come over to us formally.
Yeah, because you're not going to hear it.
No.
Besides, she decided, like, statistics homework is more important than, like,
chemistry.
So, what's on the docket tonight, yo?
It's just us dudes.
Let's talk about dicks and punching.
Which is around things we can talk about. I was thinking that we'd start off talking about, like, polyamory and evolutionary psychology as it applies to sex, but I'm sure since it's just us dudes, we'll start talking about romance.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's us, so...
Goodness. Because, I mean, sure, you could just fuck anybody, but it's just like eating chips rather than eating a good meal if there's nothing there behind it. It just leaves you feeling hollow after a while. It's
true.
Or like when you masturbate 10 times in a day and you're just kind of exhausted but not satisfied.
Yeah, I was actually recently talking to Amber, who can't hear us, about how... I was once with a girl, and we had sex 5 times in a day, and I was just, it hurt. At that point, parts of my genitalia hurt that I did not know could hurt, or I didn't even know had sensation, but they felt so hollow.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, like, I'm just shocked by that, because, like, you know, more than one good sex session a day is that's a fair amount of work, and the meat needs time to recuperate.
Like, I could maybe do 2, possibly 3 without too much struggle, depending on the latency period in between our sessions.
Yeah.
But like 5 was a lot. She was, like, going away for the summer, and I think it was understood that she may not be coming back.
Yeah.
And so it was sort of like, this could be our last chance, and it was, you know, desperate and hungry. And I don't know that I'd want to reproduce that. I mean, I will happily reproduce it, don't get me wrong. I'm not going to say no to some sex, but... I don't necessarily need that to happen again in my life.
Yeah. No, there are upper limits.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is actually, like, I think it is genuinely difficult for some guys to even think that way, because, like, the way you're socialized around it is that basically everything of your being is supposed to be towards getting more sex. Like, you're not really allowed to be like, you know, I think I've had enough sex,
right.
Or maybe I don't want sex tonight. Like,
so
that's not...
That's cultural, not so much biological. Because I can definitely, like... I like some sex, but I can do without sex. Like...
Right.
Some cuddles, you know? Like, hanging out is... I don't know. It's better. I mean, I've had some great sex, and I've had some truly mediocre sex.
Yes.
Maybe a little bit of awful sex.
Well, that is another thing, is, like, it is... It's much harder to have that perspective if you haven't had a certain amount of sex. Like, if you haven't had the experience to a degree where you're comfortable with it or familiar with it, then I could see it being a little bit difficult. Because there is, like, an edge of a biological need to experience that. There's a thing that makes it more of, like, a focal point that can be hard to ignore. But that is definitely compounded by the social message, which is also, like, you're a failure if you haven't by a certain point, or...
Yeah, you know. Absolutely. At my residential placement, we recently got a new boy, and he's like, are you celibate? Are you, like, a nun? And I'm like, I'm a married man, and you're stuck in lockup for at least 6 months. I'm pretty sure I'm getting some before you are, but they're so, like, conditioned to, like, sex equals success, and they're not getting sex. At least they're not getting the kind of sex that they want to be having. Under Prison Rape Elimination Act, none of my boys are having sex. But, and so they just attach to that, and they're obsessed with sex. And I'm like, the more you're talking about how much you're getting it on the outside, the more I know that you've never had any sex.
Yeah.
Because I've had some sex. And outside this podcast, I don't really need to be bragging about it. Like, I'm more or less like, yes, I've had sex. Not necessarily something I need to brag about.
Well, within the context of this podcast, like, we should be bragging a lot. Because, you know, that's... No, I don't know.
We had a lot of sex.
Right. I was just saying, I had a bit there, and I lost interest in it halfway through.
Yeah. I've had sex like that, too.
But no, but that does go along with, like, the general, like... you know, the fragility of masculinity as a concept. Like, it's all based on bluster, and, you know, it's all variations of the silverback running up to you and beating his chest and then not really doing anything about it, because that's supposed to be the enough.
Yeah.
It's not really built on anything. That was a sloppy analogy.
That's no, I think it's but, fine. I don't know if this quite goes with what you were saying, but I've definitely had sex with people where it is like there's, like, multiple layers between me and her. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's people she's been with in the past, or experiences she's had, or, like, what her parents would think about this, or, like, how I'm going to reenact my trauma with you in this way I can control via sex. And it's like, I just like our genitals to rub against each other a little bit here, and I feel like that's not happening.
That can be a whole other layer of difficulty. You know, just aside from, you know, the expected nervousness of you know, doing this thing with somebody who maybe you haven't done it with before, but then, yes, having to work out, like how much therapy is going to be involved in this. Or, you know, just, like, I don't know, all things that are kind of hard to actually get out in the communication phase, but which should be, is, you know, well, these are expectations I have, and, you know, this is actually kind of what I'm wanting out of this, which most people wouldn't be able to answer even if you asked them openly about that, because we don't
It's definitely
think about it.
Working on levels that are very deep. So it's like, so what are your issues? What is the baggage I have to deal with before I can actually get your panties off? Right. Or once I get your
or
panties
boxers,
off. Or boxers. Or boxers. Whatever underwear you want to wear is fine.
Yes. Yeah. Although actually, there's playing the comedy trump card of like quality, but it doesn't quite work.
No.
So
though boxers I definitely like better than other underwear I've worn. So yay boxers.
Yeah, boy shorts turn out to be my favorite variation
on girls.
On other people, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I agree with that. I recently wrote an article on Medium talking about the trans girls I occasionally get at my job and how at the trans boys at other facilities petitioned or somehow got the right to wear boxers, and someone had to say maybe they should only wear boxers like 3 weeks out of the month. But why? It's like, because we give them pads.
Wow.
So it's like, here's our concession. Yes, you can wear boxers, but you also have some state issued panties for that time of the month.
Okay. I see. No, for a second there, it just sounded like it was just pointless, vindictive bureaucracy.
No,
being
surprise.
Like, oh, well, we'll give you these, but you can only wear them on Sundays.
No, well, I guess the bureaucracy at first did not realize that you can't efficiently attach pads to boxers. Okay. Maybe someone out there is coming up with some sort of underwear solution for young trans men.
Yeah.
But I think panties are still somewhat necessary from a hygiene perspective, at least in our juvenile justice system.
Well, that does turn into a then just shock that yes, they did actually like do something about that. So good for them.
Yeah,
good
I think the state still has no idea really what to do with trans children, because I know they're like, oh, so you're a girl, here are special privileges, and it's like, no, they have to be treated like normal. Let me scale back from saying normal.
I know. It's hard because the language is so hard.
It's so ingrained. Yes, what I mean by that is, here's what the boys get. You are a girl. You get what the girls get. But you do not get a special privilege because you happen to make us feel uncomfortable.
Right.
Your mere... Nothing you're doing, young trans lady. It is merely that your presence is unexpected and difficult with the old guard, who do not really know how to deal with transgender youth.
Yeah, that is an interesting discussion in and of itself. Just the idea of how confusing that can be if you've never dealt with it, even though it should just be like a simple, you know, I don't know, it shouldn't be as difficult as it is, but it's interesting that it can be as difficult as it is. Like even using pronouns correctly is, even if you know the right way to do it, you know, asking people and that sort of thing, like it still weirdly requires some effort on the part of your brain if you weren't raised with this as a thing to expect.
I have a friend who is transitioning, and yesterday I was talking about him and I slipped and used the female pronoun. Right. And I'm sure that he would not be too upset. But, like, I've seen pictures of him. He's a him. He has mm-hmm. facial hair. My brain understands that that is a man, but I'm still used to, you were female when I met you. You were female for years. And I still have to switch it over.
Right, right. Something about, like, the way your brain categorizes identities of other people. Like it's almost like there is a data file, and even though you've overwritten the part that says, like pronoun use, it's still a little bit deeper than that. Like the yeah. old muscle memory is still there to yeah. to use the other language. And
yeah. sort of tying it back, years ago, I just started dating a new girl, and I was saying something and referred to her by my ex-girlfriend's name, and she looked at me.
Yes,
and she was definitely hurt. I'm like, you have to understand, it is simply that the word girlfriend was synonymous with that girl's name. And I have not fixed the files in my head enough.
Yeah,
my apologies, but it is not. I'm not pretending she's here. It's just I was saying the word girlfriend using a synonym, and the synonym was not yet your name. I'll work on it.
Yeah, no, that is interesting, because I do, even now, like as many years as it's been, just because perhaps I haven't had as many relationships in number. Like, I will still, like, in my, when, I haven't done it out loud. Like, it, I never end up getting the names wrong out loud. That's just because I don't use names in conversation anyways, because I don't hold on to them that well. But, you know, if I'm thinking about things like that in the context of relationship, you know, my first relationship, or my first partner's name just pops into my head as the default, still. And it's, like, there, I haven't thought about that person, like, I don't actively right. think about them ever, but every now and then that'll happen. I'll be like, oh, interesting.
Yeah. Well, and what was also difficult for me in a different transition is I dated an Emily, and then I moved on to a Melanie.
Oh,
in my head, those were very similar yes. sounds. And so I was very conscious, like, Emily, Melanie. Like, I
yeah.
conditioned myself really hard because I knew I could slip up there. And then what sucked is Emily dumped me, Tom, for a guy named Tim, and I'm like, you got lucky, because if you screw up, you can be like, oh, I'm sorry, I burped.
Right.
Obviously, right. I meant Tim right there. I don't know that she ever screwed up.
No, but I was going to say, like, actually, Emily and Melanie, like, they're close enough that they almost could be like a, you know, like a child's misbabble of,
right.
of one or the other. Yeah, that'd be a little rough.
So I started this saying that we're going to talk about polyamory
yeah.
almost entirely because I'm currently reading Dr. Chris Ryan's book, Sex at Dawn, which he wrote with his wife, Castilda. I think that I need to state that because mm-hmm. she's the co-author, and he seems to get sole credit for the most part for writing this.
Yeah.
I don't know how heavy her hand was. The style seems like the podcasts I listen to. So I imagine that at least stylistically he influenced it. But it is evolutionary psychology talking about how we came to the point where we are, and his conceit seems to be using other people's research to prove that we are not meant to be monogamous, that is an unnatural state for most of humanity, and that we see that in the failings of marriage and how discontent we are, that basically in other primate groups, you fuck around. It's just yeah. what you do.
Well, yeah, in a lot of other primate groups, and again, this is prefaced with the understanding that the myth of the, you know, the happy bonobo is not a real thing, but at the same time, it's very obvious that in most other social primate groups, like, sex is a large part of socializing. Like, it's a thing you do, like saying hi, you know, or hey, you know, or just strengthening bonds between friend groups, or
yeah,
or paying for meat, whatever it happens to be.
It's true.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. I mean, I have heard him talk before, and I know he's usually quick to state that he's also not necessarily arguing that it's the wrong thing to do, just that it's not what we're optimized for historically or evolutionarily.
Right.
He
definitely decries the whole idea that women are supposed to be these chaste and chaste creatures that. And that women want sex as much as you do, and from an evolutionary standpoint, it sort of makes sense that they get the stable guy who, you know, is going to take care of their kids, and then they fuck around with the bad boy.
Mm.
Because evolutionarily, you have the highest chance of passing on your genes and then getting someone else to take care of them.
Yeah. I mean, yes, in nature, that's like a hugely successful strategy.
Right. And the idea has tended to be prior to this that sperm is cheap and eggs are expensive. Like, yeah. I can make a billion sperm right now and waste them all and it doesn't matter. But a woman's eggs are all she's going to get. And if I impregnate a girl and then I leave, she has to raise that baby up. Now, it is not good for me evolutionarily to abandon my children.
Hmm.
I don't get to pass my genes on.
Which
is not necessarily something that either one of us wants to do.
Oh, yeah, no, that is kind of funny. We're both neither, well, I mean, I'm incapable of it, and you're just not haven't taken that step yet, or aren't necessarily needing to.
I'm disinclined.
But that is another interesting thing. Just the basic idea of how much, you know, we're always having this argument of, like is natural best, and it isn't necessarily, but at the same time, it's better to understand what the natural is, because that's what your software and your hardware is saying to you know, kind of circumvent it. Like, clearly, you know, we're clearly descended from a very violent, you know, hominid species. Chimpanzees are incredibly violent. There's a lot of social violence in their interactions. Human beings, you know, despite how awful it can seem at times, we do not have that. And we're, you know, clearly way more successful, because we can do a lot more things in a social way.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we actually work together a lot more than most other species do.
Yeah, I don't like the whole natural argument. Because there's a lot of things that I can naturally do that I don't want to do. I sort of talk to myself, convincing myself, like, that I'm part of a species, and I would like the survival of the species. I like to pass on my ideas through my writing, or just in general, improving society a little bit incrementally.
Yeah.
Whereas, and some people are there, and there are breeding stock.
Right. Well, it has, I mean, that is another kind of discussion point, is that at this point, especially in our evolution, our DNA is almost irrelevant. It's much more our cultural knowledge that becomes important, or the data that we're progressing, and it doesn't need DNA. Amusingly, we may end up going back to DNA, because it turns out that it's exceptionally good at storing information. So, you know, the computers of the future may still be DNA derived. A hard drive carries way more information than your sperm does, or if it were to carry all the knowledge of the human species.
Yeah.
You know, that's a thing. Well, okay, so the other thing that I was going with was that is the main point about human beings, is that as far as we've been able to tell interacting with other intelligent species, we're one of the few that has the choice or the option to be able to decide, you know, which of our natural tendencies are we going to engage in and which ones are we going to discard. And we have largely done that over and over again as, you know, as our society's developed. Because, you know, I was trying to think of what... I mean, yeah, well, just the shift, even the fact that we shifted from hunter-gatherers to agriculture, like, that's a really weird jump. That's not how we were optimized either, necessarily.
No, I say, I'm sure I've said on the podcast before, that I feel that society has domesticated us, that we are now serving something other than our genes.
Right.
You know, we are serving society. It has made us perpetual adolescents, a lot of us. But that is so we are cogs in a machine. Treading dangerously close to eugenics, the genes are irrelevant, because now we are saving a lot more people who... in the natural world, following natural law, would be dead.
Right.
Like, we vaccinate you.
Yeah.
You know, you're a quadriplegic. You can still lead a good life in our society.
Right.
Whereas in hunter-gatherer, you know, you're depending on the kindness of your tribe.
Right. But that is the thing, is, like, even we weren't, it wasn't that even that all, like, tribal cultures would have expelled, you know, the crippled old person. You know, you don't want to lose knowledge necessarily. That has been the one thing that, like, we've kind of kept along, is that, you know, that's what gives us an advantage to, you know, saving somebody who otherwise wouldn't survive, is that we're not valuing just the physical capability anymore. There are other things there. You know, again, poor Stephen Hawking gets dragged into this a lot. His condition isn't necessarily, I don't believe that his condition is necessarily genetic. I don't remember exactly what it was, because I'm a terrible person.
I think he has Lou Gehrig's disease.
Oh, okay, yeah. So, but that's not like... So, yeah, so that's not necessarily, like, something that we would have been like, oh no, he's going to pass it on to his genes and be terrible. No, he contracted this thing, and we were able to keep him alive and, you know, still give him the ability to pursue his interests, and to our great benefit, absolutely, you know, still do his research and figure things out and all of that. Yeah.
So even if society has domesticated us, the fact that we're keeping people like Stephen Hawking alive is kind of good. I do feel like culture is viral, and a lot of the viral quality is terrible.
Well, yeah, I mean, much like the Ebola virus, like, it's only blind luck that it happens to be capable of reproducing. Like, the viruses that, you know, there's still a lot of junk to the virus. Like religion is a massive one. You know, clinging to traditional values is another one. Because those are things in the culture that make it harder to progress usefully. But they're unfortunately part of the deal. You know, you can't just wipe the slate clean and, you know, start over, because then you'd have to do all the work again, and you'd be just as likely to end up with, you know, Republicans still. but again, the weird thing of what the argument of what is it that we value and why, you know, again, the natural part of us is like, oh well, we value strength and speed and ability to climb and ability to break nuts open, but that's not what actually gives us our best benefits. So we do also still sort of, you know, care about intelligence and problem solving and social interaction and the ability to work well with others.
Sexually, we are valuing people who are useful to where we are in our culture.
Yes.
Like, I love nerdy girls, not in like some cliche way, like Garfunkel and Oates are so friggin' sexy to me. I love them.
Yep.
And it's because they're nerdy, they're intelligent, intelligence is valuable, and they probably would hang out with me.
Right.
I mean, it helps.
Well, I feel like Kate Micucci would.
Kate Micucci would hang out with me.
Yeah, I don't know.
Kate, call me.
Yeah, seriously, Kate, we love you.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Ricky Lindholm is also awesome, but, like, different type of...
It is. Yeah, that is true.
Yeah, actually, like, I did listen. I was listening to an interview with her and had the realization of like, oh, I still really like you as an artist, but we probably wouldn't get along as people because we have vastly different belief structures on certain things.
That is true. I was a little surprised when I found out that she was trying to save her eggs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I thought that was just something from her TV show, but no, she really injects herself. I don't know if she's still doing this.
Oh,
so she can preserve her eggs for eventually spawning.
Yeah, as I say, that whole process, that's one of the, like, one of those shitty things that is way easier for men than it is for women.
Oh yeah.
Like, as a man, if you want to save your sperm for later, like, you just ejaculate and then they save it, and then you have to pay for like freezing storage. If you're a woman and you want to harvest your eggs, you have to go through this whole horrible process of injecting yourself with hormones and bloating and all this nonsense just to get, like, the ability to make them ovulate more than they're supposed to. And then a lot of needles sticking into your abdomen.
Yep.
And then you also have to pay for them to be preserved.
If you work for some Silicon Valley companies,
they
will pay for you to save your sperm and eggs. Because they want you working now.
Oh, yeah.
And you can save those eggs to later. They'll pay for it. It's...
Right.
Ideal for them, because they do not want to lose intelligent women to motherhood. Yeah, and that goes back sort of to how I feel like I am a part of society and I want to serve it in a certain way, and that doesn't necessarily mean that I want to make children. Yeah.
Well, but again, like, that's the thing, is like the passing on of your information is as important, easily as important as passing on your genetic information. I mean, that is part of what parenthood is. It's like it's both passing on your genetic information and your you know, artificial information. I don't know what to call that. But I don't necessarily think that you have to have the genetic part, because, again, that's the part that's becoming less and less important. We are still subject to some evolutionary pressures, and, you know, it is a thing. But it's not... You to contribute to the species, you do not necessarily have to, like, produce a child. That's I think a pretty, you know.
I heard not a very funny joke Okay. That's something like, I would die for two of my brothers, or four of my cousins, or eight of my second cousins, because that's the amount of genetic information they have. But other than that, like, we've got to weigh it that much.
Yeah, now, the odd thing, like, for me is, like, I've never had any remote connection to, like, family. Like, as part of the softwares that I'm missing, a big chunk of it is that sense of, like, you know, connection to most of my family, or my genetic family necessarily. Like, I don't have that. I've never had even the slightest interest in the concept of, like, making a child. That was one of the more depressing, you know, moments of my life, was realizing that, you know, this concept of sex, which was fascinating and interesting and, like, you know, hopelessly magnetic, was also connected to this awful thing of, like, oh, but you produce babies.
Yeah.
Like, that that was a huge conundrum for me, like, just developing, because I was always kind of aware of that as a weird thing, which is why I got snipped as soon as I could. But it does then create that thing of, like, just all of the things wrong with my software make it harder for me to connect to my culture or my society. Like, I do not feel that I have any of those things. So it's very much it's very similar to, like, you know, my brain's like making all these weird side references, because this was almost a plot point for one of the Metal Gear Solid games, because the main character is, like, he's sterile because he's a clone, and that is, like, there's, like, an hour at least of cutscene footage wasted on him musing about his place in the world, because he's not there to pass on genetic information. And in his case, since he's just, like, you know, this war machine, he's not even there to pass on useful information either. He's just a pointless thing, essentially, from nature's perspective. In my case, obviously, like, you know, there's art and things like that, but also just even having the awareness that my contribution to society, you know, the likelihood of it being significant is very, very small, especially just given how much information we're producing at any point in time. Like, it's very unlikely that, you know, 1,000 years from now, anybody's ever going to reference anything that I've written or made or drawn or done. You know, not even just because they probably won't be able to get the thumb drives to work, but
that is true.
But yeah, so it's, you know, that can be a weird train of thought to have, is to just be thinking about that, because, like, from a natural perspective, I'm kind of a null entity, right? I guess. which is just where, like, then the value comes from the close, or the personal impacts that I have. Like, that's really the only measurable, you know, thing that I have to go off of. Which is weird, because I'm also a hermit and I don't like hanging out with people, but
that's true. I do know, sort of tying to this, when I went to my grandmother's funeral years ago, and I was sitting there, and it suddenly occurred to me that corpse in front of the room was the reason why most of the people in the room existed. Mm-hmm. And that there was, like, 50 people in there, and they all were genetically related to the dead body in the front of the room.
Yeah.
And it seemed very strange to me. And that they would, like, echo, their genes would echo out further. And the other day, I went to a sort of family reunion, family party, and it occurred to me how many of my cousins don't have children, and they're my age, and how I don't know that they're going to have children, and I don't know what that is, because I definitely feel like maybe I have a skewed perspective, but I feel like more people are not having children. Like, a lot of people are having a lot of children, but there's a lot of people I know, like, on my sampling size of Facebook, who are like, yeah, I don't have children, I don't want children, or I've not gotten around to having children, but I'm 40-something, so I'm probably not going to have children.
Yeah.
And so, why is culture, why is society making us not want to have children? And I don't want to have children, so I'm not looking for a defense.
No, but, well, that is the odd thing, is, like, there is still kind of, there's definitely a cultural pressure to have kids, though. Like, it's still the expected thing. I think the UK right now is actually classifying people who are single and who are, or it's like classifying you as infertile if you're single.
And so you have a disability.
Yeah.
Because you don't have a partner.
Yeah, as a weird you know, weird thing. And like culturally, you know, there's still a stigma if you're, especially it's less, it affects men less. It always does. But there is still a difficult thing if you're a woman and you don't want kids, like that's a fight you have to have with people, because right. A lot of people don't, you know, are like, what? No, justify yourself.
At my job the other day, apropos of nothing, one of the guards, who I think has 7 children, is like, so, you haven't any children anytime soon? I'm like, yeah, I'm not so sure about that. He's like, does your wife want them? I'm like, you know. He's like, well, if she wants them, you're going to have children. And I'm like, is that really how that works? He's like, I never wanted children, but then my wife got pregnant, so I married her.
That's what it is. It's that whole, like, oh, you think you don't want kids, but this is what happened to me, so...
Right.
I'm going to console myself by assuming it'll happen to you, too. Yeah, I hate that. I hate that so much. So I guess that is usually the way that it hits men, is the whole, like... You know, you're like, oh, yeah, no, I know, I never want kids. And then people immediately go to the, oh, well, just wait till you meet the right one, because she'll probably want kids. It's like, well, no, that by definition makes her not the right one.
We're reproductive dead ends in society, and our genes should hate us.
Well, I mean, they should, but at the same time, like, I think that there is evidence that not every member of a social group is a breeding pair.
Right.
Like
when I told my therapist about this, because I had serious existential angst trying to figure this out, but now I'm on drugs, so the existential angst is less so.
Nice.
And she's like, well, do you have any contact with children? I'm like, I have 6 nieces and nephews, and I work with juvenile delinquents. She's like, well, then you're fine, because I'm still dealing with children. Right. I'm having exposure to them, and thus I'm... hopefully improving the next generation. Although I have very little, like, I'm not influencing my nieces and nephews except by what I buy them for Christmas. And most of my juvenile delinquents end up back in the system, or they mostly end up back in the system. Like, our recidivism rate is above 80%. So, and even those that stay out are not really success stories. They just didn't get caught again.
Yeah. But I mean, it is... just because of the way children work, like, if you're setting a relatively healthy example, that affects them. Not directly. They might not ever be able to point back to it, but that is kind of how it works. Like, they learn by looking at what's going on around them. So really, you just being healthy and happy is, you know, that can have a big impact.
Yeah. And I work at a library with some kids. I keep doing programs with them. And I care about them. Like, I want to guide them, although I can guide them in only a very specific, small way. And oftentimes not the way I want to. And I definitely have, like, attachment to people under 18. And which is nurturing, but I wouldn't want, like, I'd like to be like, hey, fist bump, good to see you. You're doing well? Great. Here's some ice cream. But I wouldn't want to take them home.
Well, yeah, no, and that is the other difference, is, like, yes, doing the hard work of all the raising of a child is very different from, you know, just interacting with them you know, getting to have fun and send them home.
I have thought, and this is morbid, I'm like, under what circumstances would I just happen to have children? And I know that if my brother and his wife both died, and for some reason we had to take in one of the nibblings, ideally one of the younger ones, I think, I'd be like, yes, I would do that. I would probably, you know, inconvenience myself mightily to give these kids a good home for a while, but I would not want to be their terminal parent. But I will take care of them. Like, I've offered to have, like, a stronger role, to be like, oh, you know, I'd love if I could, like, take them out for their birthdays and stuff. But they have a really good support system, and we're very low down on that. So we just see them at parties and on family vacation, and that's about it.
I don't even think I would be able to do that. Like,
and I understand.
It's just one of those, like, it's hard enough taking care of a cat. At the same time, like, you know, again, as a species, we're generally good at dealing with crises and getting through it somehow. So
right. I'm sure that if I were in that situation, I'd be good at it, but I don't necessarily, like, I have things I want to do, and, like, I have a lot of things, like, I've thought about this a lot, like, you know, I will maybe never backpack around Europe, because there are other things I want to do, like, that sounds great, but it also scares me. And children really interrupt a lot of that. I know this podcast was supposed to be a polyamory, but it ended up being about parenthood. Well, they're tied. It's genes.
It's okay.
And so, but children are inconvenient.
Actually, polyamory is pretty easy. It's the main thing that, or at least in terms of a PSA, the most important thing to know about it is that you're just taking a relationship and you're cubing it or squaring it or otherwise making it exponentially large. And that's the thing you need to think about, because it's not just fun and fucking around. You have to deal with all of the stuff that you deal with in a relationship times two or three or four or whatever.
Yeah. That sounds really difficult. I would not want to do that.
Yes. Love may be infinite, but time and space and energy are not.
Right. And I think sort of tying it together, I can have relationships with other people that don't involve sexuality, because I think a lot of times polyamory has to involve the sexuality, despite what Tumblr would tell you.
I can have intimate
relationships, and sexuality doesn't have to be a part of it. They can go off. I don't have to be jealous that they have other friends. Right. I don't have to deal with, you know, their bullshit. I can send them home.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Like, I can love the best for them without necessarily wanting to get into their pants.
Right.
And honestly, like, I know I've talked in the podcast before, like, my libido is really spotty these days. Like, I like Amber a great deal, but aside from that, I tend not to feel it. Though the other day, I was at CVS, and there was a bard girl, college girl, and she was wearing, like, a very tight top and no bra, and either she was excited or was cold, and my libido's like, I want that. Right. And I'm like, you do? You want that? Like, it didn't even look at her face. And I'm like, libido, let's focus. It's like, boobs. I'm like, libido!
Yes, libido is clearly, it has its own control box, and it's you almost have to think of it as, like, it's its own virtual machine. Just be like, okay, you're going to run in the background.
Right.
Fine, but can you leave me out of it sometimes?
Yeah, and then it was, like, for a day and a half, I was, like, I don't want to use it, like, aroused, but not in a sexual way, like hyper-aroused, like, just keen.
Yeah, well, like, something caught your interest, and then you're going to be more aware of it.
But I'm like, it's gone now. You have to let it go.
Right.
You saw some nipples, but they're gone now, and there are other nipples that you can actually touch.
Infinite other nipples, I mean, you can't touch all of those. No. But yeah, like...
And I know, like,
yeah.
I would say that 99.9% of porn does literally nothing for me. Like, it's just empty.
Yeah.
And,
well, yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely, like, when I'm around, you know, my significant other... Oh, well, actually, no, that's right. That's an open secret. We've had Kest on the podcast before, so...
Yeah,
When I'm around Kest, like, yeah, I have almost no interest in porn. It is, however, something that pops up when I'm on my own.
I could see that, and I think that probably the thing is I have not been alone in 5 years. Almost 5 years. Amber's been around.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, and then... And then you're just stuck with it, and it's like, you're
just stuck. And, you know, instead of having, you know, meaningless porn, you have meaningful relationships with a significant other.
Yeah.
For whom you have to buy pads and toilet paper. And it's so much better than porn. Sorry, guys. I know that you're supposed to be like, oh, my fucking wife ruined my life. No, my wife's awesome.
Yeah, no, well, that's a weird meme, too, because that has been, like, a simultaneous... You know, you get the message of you have to marry and have kids, but also, like, you're expected to be miserable also. Like, you're given both things at the same time. Except for, like, you know, the schlubby sitcom guy who even though he keeps wanting more, is, like, just ends up at the end of the day being happy with what he's got. But also, like, his life is still kind of ruined by, you know, having this rigid setup. I don't know. So that is the thing about relationships. It's like, probably the most damning part of the way that we do monogamy is the weird expectation that it's always going to be permanent. Because that is a counter argument I've heard, is that it's not so much that, you know, it's not so much that we're naturally polyamorous as, like, we're, if you just look at the way we actually behave, serial monogamy is way more, is like the norm. That's what the actual norm is.
I was definitely a serial monogamous when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And I can't actually imagine Amber not being around.
Yeah.
Like, for a hypothetical, like, I'm sure that at some point I would be like, well, that's a pretty woman. Oh, we get along. I guess we can kiss. but it's not something I'd want to do. But I know as a teenager, it was, you know, and it wasn't that I wanted sex, although sexy things did happen, though not sex, because I was terrified of sex, but it was just like, I want this romantic connection, I'm very excited, this is great, it's not so great anymore, we're broken up.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't get past that. I'm not saying that I'm better for having gotten past it when I was a teenager.
No,
I'm grateful that I did.
But that's like a lot of things. Our society, as a society, is very, like, hands-off about all of the important shit. Like they're again, you know, we'll teach you how to do trigonometry, but not how to balance your taxes.
Yeah.
Even though that's an actual thing you have to do in your life. Which I don't want that to be an anti-math argument. That's just the common... You're statistically way less likely to need to know how to do trigonometry in your day-to-day activities than balancing your taxes, which you have to do at least once a year. Or even your checkbook, for that matter. But yeah, no, relationship things. Like, we have talked about that before. You learn almost nothing except what you're shown on TV or by experiencing what your parents experience.
Right.
And that's pretty shitty because, you know, maybe you're unlucky and your parents have an awful relationship. And then you're going to grow up like Dan Harmon, you know, not knowing how to interact with women because you're basing it all on the horrible relationship your parents had.
And unfortunately, I see a lot of lower class boys where they, you know, they're not so successful of relationships, unfortunately. Or like, you're too busy trying to work 3 jobs to keep your family afloat.
Oh, yeah.
So you get home and you are resentful and pissed off and you're not having... these emotionally supportive Gwyneth Paltrow sort of relationships.
Oh yeah, no. Very few people actually get to be the schlubby guy with the supermodel wife.
I know.
And that, of course, going back to just the general idea that it's still absurd that poverty is even a thing that we allow to exist as a society. It's clearly the root cause of the majority of the things we hate about society. Like oh, you hate crime and violence. Well, poverty. that's your leading cause. But I mean, that does kind of fit along with just the weird idea that our society, it chugs along, but it has almost no interest in producing useful civilians. It doesn't care that people fall through the cracks. It doesn't care that you know, the majority of citizens are struggling to survive, because it doesn't have to. It's not an actual living thing. It's just a thing that exists and perpetuates itself.
Right. That we perpetuate.
Well, right, because we're born a part of it, and just like our skin cells, they don't care if we succeed or fail, they just want to keep doing what they're doing.
Yeah, and we counter other people's cultures, and they are a threat to our culture, and so we have to fight them.
Now, there's an interesting question that always comes up. So cultural homogeneity is suicide as well, like just like genetic homogeneity is mm-hmm. suicide. However, it's also clear that unification of some sort is a necessary thing. Like, we kind of have to become a unified culture, but can we become a unified culture within, you know, get the Star Trek ending without becoming a homogenized culture? Is that a thing that's actually possible? That's the thing I think about. Because, you know, again, like, if we're ever going to get off the rock, we have to become a single group and not a bunch of warring semi-groups. Like,
but we're still tribal.
I know. Which is the argument then being like, we need to become one tribe. But at the same time, can we become one tribe without extinguishing?
And the only way that I can guarantee that would happen is if there were a culture threatening the Earth culture.
Yeah.
So we need a big octopus monster.
It's true. Even in the actual Star Trek lore, the thing that unifies humanity is global thermonuclear war followed by first contact with a thankfully, you know, peaceful species.
And from all my research of UFOs and stuff, that's not going to happen, people. We're not going to encounter aliens. They're not going to visit us. If they exist out there, and if they have not died off already, they're not going to find us. Sorry, guys.
Or they're going to eat us.
They probably won't eat us because we're probably toxic to them.
Oh, that might be true. That might be true.
You know, I don't know if we discovered a culture that we wouldn't try to extinguish it if we were the stronger one.
No, obviously, based on how we behave, like, it's not a question. We would. We just would. Unless humanity significantly changed that would be our first step. It wouldn't even bother with negotiation. It would be like, oh, well, you're smaller than us, and you taste good, maybe, so I guess we're going to eat you?
Sorry, all guys. Right. We definitely eat other sapient species, so yeah. Sucks to be you.
Yep. Yeah, if you got complaints, tell it to the cows.
It's true. And I do have to say, like, I am philosophically part of the problem, because I feel like we should infest whatever rock we can find with microbes.
Hmm.
Just because, you know, I don't like all of our earthly genetic information in one place. So if we can possibly infest Mars with microbes, I'd feel good about that. And I guess we don't want to do that because we don't want to taint other things with our Earth microbes in case there are Martian microbes or Ioan microbes.
Yeah.
But I sort of feel like, well, too bad. We need to infest things. We need other people, other things to have our virus. Especially if there's nothing going on there. Infest.
Yeah, that being like perhaps one of the other like gigantic philosophical discussions that should probably happen before it's something we can actually do, because it is a question. Like, at survival is a necessity, but you know, are we ever going to reach a point philosophically where you can say, okay, there's enough people? I don't think you can as a living organism. That's not the natural way to do it.
I mean, I think people argue, like, well, you can put the entire population of Earth in Texas.
Yeah.
But should we? It feels like there's a lot more people than we need. I mean, yeah. There are a lot more. We need, like, basically 10,000 individuals to repopulate again. We have 7 billion. And a lot of our problems seem to come from overpopulation. And it's not going to get better if you keep fucking and making babies.
No. But again, like most of the problems with the concept of overpopulation are that it's too many people in a concentrated space. Also, that our resource distribution is shitty.
Yeah.
Again, we produce plenty of food. That's not at all the problem.
And a lot of people are like, well, we can make more children, rather very impoverished or like first world Americans, sort of like. Well, I've got a huge yard, so we can't be that bad off yet. But yeah. It's like, hey, you're not in Mumbai.
Right.
It's
right.
Worse in Mumbai. I don't know if it's worse in Mumbai. Being a cultural chauvinist here.
Yeah, no. It depends on which part of the cultural ladder you're on. Because if you're in the upper crust, you're fine.
The other day, I was explaining to a kid the concept of the shit sandwich. Mm. I'm like, yeah, the more bread you have, the less shit you have to eat. And it was like a light bulb went off over his head. I'm like, that's how it works. Tell other people about the shit sandwich.
Although you wouldn't be able to explain that on CBS, apparently, as we discovered.
Yeah.
Because shit is still a bleepable word. Crap is fine.
Yeah.
Weirdly.
Yeah, and dick is now an okay word to say. I don't know how it works.
Yeah, I mean, it's been so long since I watched TV. Like, just.
And now that the gentleman whose name I will not mention has brought pussy into the public lexicon again, apparently the news has to say the word pussy 10 times.
Yes, yeah. I mean, let's hope that that's his one significant cultural contribution. We already know what it isn't, but...
No, unfortunately.
That would, yeah. No, the one good, I mean, he's sort of an example of like the idea of letting things get so bad that you have to address them, because, you know, I'm pretty sure we might get some new like sexual assault laws out of the current situation.
Yeah, I was talking to Amber about like if I was forced to endorse Trump, what like damning by faint praise could I give? And I'm like, he's really opened up the public dialogue to sexual consent again.
Yep. Yeah, oh man. No, I still, you know, it always comes around. We can't, I mean, it's a thing happening right now. We can't avoid talking about it. I still really hate the fact that, you know, the gambit of running somebody so crazy that Hillary Clinton seems likable is going to work. Like,
yeah.
At this point, there is no solid argument against, you know, or there's no solid argument to vote for Trump at all. There never really was, but like it's so fucking absurd that, you know, as dumb as the argument of like vote for the lesser evil is, it it's so hard to argue that there's any other same choice.
Yeah, I definitely...
Excuse me.
Yep. I definitely miss some of the Republicans that I sort of was like, well, you shouldn't win.
Yeah.
Like, but I'm like, McCain, Romney, come back to us. I would much rather listen to you argue against Hillary Clinton.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, but apparently there is, like, actually surfacing evidence. This is the most frustrating thing, is to be on evidence and to see, or to be on Reddit, and to see a post about, you know, WikiLeaks revelations or something, and be like, oh, interesting, I had suspicions. And then you look over and, oh, shit, it's fucking Donald Trump's, like, subreddit that's posting it. Because then you can't upvote that shit, because it's awful. But at the same time, yes, there's, you know, more and more damning evidence coming out about her, but Trump is so fucking awful, it doesn't matter anymore. It's, you know, people are even forgetting that Hillary is, like, an awful person because Trump is so fucking awfuler.
Yep.
It's really frustrating.
And I think by the time I put this podcast up, we will have the answer.
Oh,
either,
yeah.
I guess either Hillary wins, or I guess we take the cyanide pill and we're done.
Yeah.
Because as a society, if we actually elect Trump, we've definitely poisoned ourselves.
Now, apparently, like, the electoral math at this point, like, it's not actually possible for him to win. He cannot get enough electoral college votes to win.
But then he won't concede defeat. He's going to tell his followers to cause armed insurrection.
Thankfully, there's a lot less of them than he would like to believe, or at least of that type. I mean, that is... I have been seeing stories about how, like, the one uplifting thing about it is that he's the last gasp of that generation. And if, yes, it's way worse than normal because it's desperate and dying and, you know, hopefully going to be gone forever. But this does really make me infinitely more concerned about what's going to happen next time. Like, they ran a literal Hitler this time as the opposition. So, yeah, what's going to come after? Are we just going to have the Democrats split into, like, Democrat, you know, Democrat right and Democrat center? Or, well, yeah. it'd be center right. Let's not do it for kid ourselves.
Well, you know Kate McKinnon, right?
Sort of.
Yeah, well, she's been playing Hillary Clinton on very funny.
Oh, is it? Are those the debates that he's, like, trying to sue over?
The Senate? Yes, life? It is.
Okay. Yeah,
but her playing Hillary Clinton, she's like, so who are you going to vote for in this election? The Republican or Donald Trump? And I'm like, well done.
Oh, shit. Okay. Maybe that would be worth looking at. I haven't seen any of those.
Genuinely pretty... But it's such a parody of actual events. So yeah. When you make comedy of it, it's like, no, that's pretty much what happened.
Oh, right. Yeah. The Poe's Law, the thing where at this point you can't tell the satire from the reality. Which we were saying, like, 2 years ago, even... It's just, I don't know. You can never assume that you've reached the pinnacle of whatever it is, either in either direction. So there apparently is no bottom and there's no ceiling either.
If we just had enough parents setting good lessons for their children, maybe we wouldn't need libertarians.
Yes.
Sorry, libertarians. Gary Johnson's not gonna win.
Oh yeah. Oh fuck no. So speaking of disappointments, man, like, what the fuck was up with John Oliver and his hit piece on Jill Stein?
Yes, he definitely did that.
Yeah, really confusing. Like I don't know, like, if he actually sold out or if it's just that he doesn't actually care about the things he talks about and just says whatever the writers put in front of him.
That's sort of my feeling.
Because it was really bad. Like, yeah. you can't live in a world where Donald Trump is an actual candidate and then be like, oh, this person's not a viable option because she used to be a hippie singer. Like, what? No. Yeah. If we have to take both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton seriously, you can't use the absurdity of the person, you know, real
Jill
or imagined.
Jill Stein is way more likable if we're going by likability.
Oh, yeah. No, she did an awesome, like, she did a town hall discussion with the Young Turks while suffering from a cold. Dig at Hillary. And yeah, it was really good. She referenced the John Oliver's points and rebutted them where necessary. She had
like
to,
an adult rather than
yeah,
pouting. Wow.
Yeah, no, it was pretty good. I mean, because sometimes you see something like that and you're like, oh well, I mean, it always puts a doubt in your mind, and then you see the person talking again, and it's like, oh well, okay, no, they're not a Muppet. She can actually argue these points and has better answers than Gary Johnson's. Like, there that was kind of interesting, the time how he flips out whenever the spoiler issue is mentioned.
Yes.
Whereas, like, she has a reasoned argument against it, and then he's just like,
but he's still doing better than her in
yeah
the polls.
Well, because he's an easier jump for the people who jumped from Bernie to Trump. Like, jumping to Gary Johnson would be an easier step for them than Jill Stein, because Jill Stein is just, you know, well, I mean, one, she's a woman.
She's a woman. But, and yeah, in a proper system, she would be what a Democrat is.
Yeah. I mean, that is, like, I do also agree with the articles that talk about how we deserve better than Jill Stein. She's also not the ideal candidate at all. She's just infinitely better than you know, what we had, or what we actually have. And like Bernie, I'm super confused by, because, like, again, this whole circus has essentially undone everything that he worked for, since, you know, again, Clinton being so awful has united everybody, you know, from both sides against Trump, because they have to. I don't know. It's really dumb.
Yeah, another thing really in the SNL things that basically, like, you don't even have to run against Trump. You just have to let him talk, and mm-hmm. he will undo himself. And he
yeah.
has
yeah.
for most people. I still know people who are voting for Trump. Like, I can understand not liking Hillary. God, can I ever understand that.
Yeah.
But deciding that Trump is the answer to Hillary...
Well, I mean, I guess that was kind of another thing there's also... So at the same time that, you know, it's becoming a, like, the sanity vote, despite all of my protestations, is becoming, like, you know, you can't vote for Trump. You can't. I don't think he has a chance to win. Anyway, I'm getting myself derailed. But anyways, no, just the conflation that a lot of people, once they've made the mental decision of, like, oh, well, okay, Trump is so fucking awful, we have to go with Hillary Clinton... It's almost like once you've made that decision, you also then by default, you know, forget again everything awful that Hillary Clinton may have. So it's not enough that you're voting for Hillary Clinton, you're still expected to endorse her, and like that's not a thing that a lot of us can do. Like I still have no fucking clue what I'm going to do at this point. But
me,
you know,
either. Like
even in the scenario where I actually, you know, vote for Clinton, I can't endorse her then also. I can't go and tell people that she's a good choice.
No.
Because she's not. She's just not... I don't know.
The person who I think I agree with the most in this election is Glenn Beck, in saying you have a moral and ethical responsibility not to elect Trump. So elect Hillary, and then you fight her legally in every way you can.
I mean, and that's the shitty thing, though, is that that's still, though, we know that doesn't work because it didn't work in Obama. It didn't.
No.
So
they obstructed him, but
yeah.
That does not, like, I would like a government that could work together across the reach across the aisles, as they say, like, and we're not getting that.
No. The one good thing that may come of this is that we're probably, there's a very good chance that the Republicans are going to lose everything else. Regardless of what happens with Trump, because like this, all the Senate races are up. That is something. I don't necessarily think, you know, Hillary being in the White House is going to be much better for you know, the Supreme Court picks, because she's still probably going to pick people who are, you know, corporate whores, and they're not going to be that progressive, probably not. So I don't know. I mean, they might not. You know, throw Muslims over here in jail or endorse doing that or make decisions that would lead to that, but they're still probably not going to have problems with us blowing them up everywhere else in the world, which is still a major concern.
Yeah. So I guess final thoughts.
that I think all of that was mine. I don't know.
I accept that.
I'm too depressed and exhausted now.
I guess we've touched on a lot of topics tonight.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No. So yeah, like, you know, relationships, they're worth the effort.
I agree with that. I think that, yeah. I don't know, I want to say relationships are what make us human, but we've seen that other sapient creatures have relationships. Yeah. I guess being neurotic about it is what makes us human.
Mm.
And overthinking things, because bonobos are not overthinking things.
No.
And I don't think most other sapient species on this planet are overthinking. The dolphins are not like, but you snuggled with that one. They're just, I mean, you let that research assistant give you a foot job. Like, they just accept it.
Yes.
Okay. So, we don't have Amber here to say goodnight.
Goodnight, Amber!
Goodnight, Amber!
Did you hear the squeak?